Welcome again for those of you who are here for the meditation period, and for those just arriving now, both here in this physical space and for those arriving here via Zoom, welcome. Nice to be with you. I was reminded in the introductory comments that not every Wednesday night offers or can accommodate an in-person experience. I had forgotten that, and I feel personally fortunate that I can myself sit in the same room with a group of folks and have the opportunity to explore the Dharma, to reflect a little bit on the meaning of this practice, these many practices in this path, on my own life and our life together as a community and as human beings who have to live in the same world together. And again, if you're logging on from Zoom, thank you for being here. I hope that the way we spend our time tonight will be beneficial in some way for everyone. As mentioned, I wanted to talk tonight about why we practice. And I think that I've done this before. I didn't necessarily go back through past talks or notes to confirm that I have done this before. However, I was walking up the stairs, and right before I opened the door, I had this thought. I think I've done this before, though that was not apparent to me when I was making some notes in preparation for being here. And, you know, I want to say, as a way of an introduction, that I think for most teachers, and definitely for me, I'm trying to speak about the Dharma in ways that are not only relevant to me, but stem directly from recent experiences. And sometimes that will be a response to something I saw in the news or a conversation I had with a student earlier in the week, for example. I think in this case, though I've been practicing for a long time, or maybe because I've been practicing for a long time, quite intimately over the past couple of weeks, and also maybe more loosely over the past several months, I think I've been asking this question of myself. Why do I practice? Why? It takes so much effort. It takes time. You know, just, you know, looking up at the large TV screen and seeing the faces and looking around here at the room, and there's a lot, you know, if we did some arithmetic and we took this amount of people and considered all the things that we could be doing right now, that would be an extraordinarily long list of things. You know, why have I continued to practice for 25 years? I recently made some very big decisions in my life that would allow me to practice more. So why do we do this? So I don't have the answer to why you practice or should practice. And if you were to ask me that question, why should I practice? I might say, I don't know. I really don't know. And then I would say, well, let's talk. Let's have coffee, or let's get on Zoom. Let's sit on the couch and we could get to know each other. And I imagine, I have confidence that together we could figure that out. If this practice tradition is potentially beneficial for you, I think we could figure that out. So why we practice is quite personal to start. I think that's an important starting place. I think that our history, where we come from, early formative experiences, economics, our physical health, maybe our education, certainly race, gender, sexual orientation, opportunities, lack of opportunities, exposure to religious teachings as young people, as middle-aged people, as elders. So we can't, I would argue, necessarily say the Dharma path is this. This is what it looks like. You do it, you do it, you do it, you do it. And it will, you know, if you do it, whatever it is, it will work. It will be beneficial for you. It's not quite like that, I don't think. The way we practice and the reasons we practice additionally might, we're taught not to use the word should these days, but might and probably should shift according to how we understand both the Dhamma and through Dhamma practice how we come to understand our mind, our own mind. Our minds are very different. Just like our histories are very different, just like our present day circumstances are very different. We share a lot, but our lives are not the same. Therefore, why we practice is not fixed or static. So why you initially came to practice, whether that was 3 months ago or 13 years ago or 3 decades ago, why you practice today might be different. And if you have been practicing for a long time, and some of you have, you might even take some time tonight, this weekend, before the end of the calendar year, and you might sit down with a journal or just quietly at home or with a teacher you trust. And you might visit this question, why am I practicing right now? Right? Why do I do this? Why do I spend this time? We could say that our own individual Dhamma path is rooted in the past, is edited or modified in the present, and is refined with the wisdom that arises through our practice. So it's alive. It's evolving. It's going to shape itself in relationship to a great many conditions and our willingness to engage it in that way as fluid and emergent might have something to do with how maturely we hold it, understand it, relate to it, etc. And if we look at the long history of the Buddha Dharma, we have a record or a list of many reasons why people have practiced and might choose to practice. So also, and I hope that this is not contradictory, it could be, it could sound that way, there's probably a lot we share despite our uniqueness. There are probably reasons of overlap or some degree of sameness and the individual reasons that we might, as an individual, choose to learn meditation, step onto the Dhamma path, study the Dharma. So there's also, I think, when we get to know our own mind, when we get to know other people in the Sangha, we start also to, while we individuate, we start to see a universality in logic or rationale, right? And we have these teachings, often groupings, literally numerical listings that would be familiar to some of you. We have the classical or historically significant reasons for practice. So there is, if someone says, why should I practice? There is a reason. There is an answer. Why should I practice? There is a reason we could practice. There is an answer to that question. We could practice to develop concentration, right? We could want to develop concentration for more focus. We could want to develop more concentration to stabilize our mind. We could want to develop concentration as a foundation for other types of meditation practice, mindfulness or insight, for example. So we might desire or aspire to a mind that is more collected, a mind that has the experiential quality of being gathered, in a sense, right? I've been practicing for quite some time, as I mentioned, and, you know, I still have these days when the mind feels like it's like a ping pong ball, or what's the machine where you pull the lever and you let it go? What's that game? Pinball. So ping pong, pinball. Like you know, I have a sense of that. There's a kind of a bounciness or a lack of control. There's some kind of erratic energy where I guess maybe you have a little more control with a ping pong ball, but that pinball, it just sort of goes wherever it wants to go. You watch it under the glass and it's just like, why is it going over there? And, you know, so our mind is like that sometimes. My mind is like that sometimes. And it can be very skillful, it can be very helpful to collect or to gather the mind, right? Like to create a small, narrow channel for that pinball ball to go, right? Don't give it so much room. Feels better. Concentration feels good, actually. It feels very good sometimes. It feels so good that there's warnings or cautions in the teachings to not get too hooked on concentration. It can feel so good that there are warnings not to mistake concentration for wisdom. Right? So concentration is very healthy. That's an appropriate goal if this sounds appealing. That would be useful to work on. It would be useful to develop concentration. I don't know about all of you, but when I was young, in my early 20s, I wanted to find an authentic way of being in the world. I was very interested in contributing to and being a part of a kind of culture or society that was different than the world I observed around me. And I became very interested in the idea of wisdom as it was presented in the Buddhist tradition. I thought that wisdom would be one way of achieving some of those early goals of beginning to understand how I might contribute to and hopefully live within a world that was different than the one I was observing around me. Wisdom is sometimes described as seeing things for what they are. And when we see things for what they are, or when we see the way things actually are, this allows for an increase of skillful behavior. And this in turn has the power to reduce human suffering. Right? So we have to see how things actually are, which is often, not always, but which is often different than our perception of how things are. So we could say that over the long arc of practice, our perceptions become more accurate. And that's very beneficial. If my perceptions become more accurate, I become less prone to unskillful behavior. And hopefully I can relate to each of you or to my friends or to the person at the grocery store in a way that fosters more ease in those interactions, and I would argue literally in the world. Right? Like one step at a time, one positive, kind, or wise interaction at a time. So probably many of us practice because we're interested in wisdom, however it is that we might individually define wisdom. Right? This is a wisdom tradition, and insight practice is a straight path toward wisdom. Actually, it probably feels not so straight sometimes. That it is a direct line, potentially, to greater wisdom. We have the Brahma Viharas, representing four mental qualities or mind states, literally places that we can abide. The divine abodes, the divine abidings, kindness and compassion, equanimity and joy. Sounds good, right? Very, very real possibilities for every person here tonight. Very real possibilities for anyone who chooses to take up this practice. Okay. The practice tradition, the great broad range of teachings are in place explicitly to support the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas. So, talk about a better world to live in. Kindness, compassion, equanimity, which is a mind that stays stable in the context of adversity, and joy. Okay. Let's live in that. Let's live in that world together if we can, right? Yeah. we might practice to transform the three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion, into their opposite and more beneficial states, generosity, kindness, and wisdom. So we could become interested in decreasing the toxicity of the world we live in, literally. The energetic, psychic, psychological toxicity. We feel it, right? I drove here from Gloucester, Massachusetts, somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour and 15 minutes, depending on traffic. It's a little bit more spacious out where I live. The population density is a little bit less. And this is not a new experience. It's just a reminder. As soon as I got off the highway, about 45 seconds after I got on the highway, after I got off the highway, there was a car behind me leaning on the horn. And it was a reminder. I'm now in a place where people move faster. I've lived in the city. I ran a Dharma center across town. I've worked at colleges and hospitals in the city. I've spent a lot of time here. I'm not knocking the city. I miss the city. I don't live in the city right now. And there's a kind of wiring or moment, like there's like an energy in cities, like, you know, like, get out of my way. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough time. I don't have enough space. You know, so I'm going to honk my horn at you. You know, it happens in other places. It's toxic. It's toxic. This might not sound like a Dharma practice, but there are times when I get in my car and I don't always remember, because I'm also, you know, being a Dharma teacher doesn't mean mindfulness is always boldly intact, right? I don't always remember. And one of my favorite practices, it feels like a very deep practice, honestly. I get in my car and I say, if I get the opportunity to let somebody go in front of me, I'm going to do that. That's real. That's something I do. Right? And as a teacher once taught me to do, I watch my mind before I do it, while I'm doing it, and after. And you know what happens? Can you guess? Have you done this or something like this? What happens to the mind when you're thoughtful or kind or generous? What happens? Have you noticed? Contentment, kinder to yourself, slower. You want to be really happy? Let other people go first. Give them the parking spot. Let someone, if you're standing there shoulder to shoulder with all your groceries, and you notice yourself, I'm going to get in line before this person, because I'm going to get home and watch. I'm not going to miss the beginning of the Seinfeld reruns. Like, it's all about me. Let the other person go first. I'm not kidding. Like, this not it. I'm being playful, but I'm very serious about how we cultivate the mind when we're not on the meditation cushion. Being generous gives the mind a kind of buoyancy. Right? Anytime we turn away from self-preservation, sometimes it's very appropriate to preserve the self. Often, when we turn away from activities of selfing, of self-preservation, the mind loosens, softens, open, and anything, happiness, the experience of kindness, joy, just a general buoyancy, It's right there. It's that easy, right? This is not a complete list. And one more point I'd like to make, and remember, these are possible reasons we might practice based on clearly defined intentions, aspirations that we see all throughout the Buddhist teachings. We might choose to develop a naturally informed sense of ethics, meaning, and I think this is important, meaning not something moralistic by way of subscribing to externally imposed rules, but rather knowing how to utilize our mind, body, and speech in ways that create greater harmony in our own life and in the world. So I'm not going to tell you what ethics are. I can give you suggestions. You can give me suggestions. And what it comes down to is engaging and utilizing our own body, speech, and mind that creates greater harmony. I once proposed to a fairly prestigious Buddhist institution that is mostly interested in the academic or scholarly study of the Dharma a program on ethics. I had taught there many times, and my courses were successful, and I figured I could get away with whatever I wanted at this point. And they said, well, nobody really wants, that's not a very sexy topic. Nobody wants to do that, right? Trust me, you do. if you can allow me this moment of, humorous authority, like, I bet we all want a mind in a community around us that's more harmonious. I bet we all want that, right? So I'll share with you a short passage where we see many of these aspirations of practice or results of practice. A passage that shows how integral they are to the path. From the Dhammapada, good is virtue until life's end. Good is virtue until life's end. Good is faith that is steadfast, continuous, consistent, done with continuity. Good is the acquisition of wisdom. And good is the avoidance of harm. So good in this context could be understood as useful or beneficial. As simple as that. This is useful stuff. This is probably of benefit to us. Beneficial and worth our time. This is why some of us are here. 2 hours and 15 minutes on a Wednesday night. Worth our time. And good also, simply because it is aligned with how things are. These qualities of mind that are pointed toward, which are the result of practice, manifest in our own mind, body, community, the world we live in, as we become more attuned to the way things are. And this is the Dhamma. Dhamma means true or truth or real, or sometimes I define it as accurate. Simply what's accurate. That's the Dhamma. What's accurate? Dhamma points to something inherent or natural in the world, in the universe, in our own mind, in our own heart. Dhamma also aims to reveal the ways our own habits of perception conceal this truth, obscure this truth. Behaviors in body, speech, and mind follow perceptions, and thus when we don't see things accurately, we cannot possibly move in the world in a way that is skillful. This is almost as reliable or certain as arithmetic. It's just how it works. So, we might say that regardless of the many individual reasons we may choose to follow the Buddhist path or decide to learn meditation or continue to learn more about meditation, that we aim to align ourselves with something more representative of how things actually are. Meaning that that is probably something that we all share. If we know how the world works, okay, if we know how the world works, we will know how to work within that world. This would be very different than the feelings of distress and discontent that come with feeling like we are at odds with the world, at odds with our life, and at odds with our own mind and body. It's almost hard to argue with, right? I'd like to continue with this exploration that is a response to the question why we practice. And in doing so, I don't think what I'm going to say next is in addition to what I've already said. I think what I'm going to try to express is merely a different way of emphasizing some of the same things, or maybe the few ideas that I have left to share are ones that contain, in a different way, contain the ideas already presented. When I first started meditating, I wanted to be a really good meditator. I probably even wanted other people to think I was a good meditator. And this says a lot about how I grew up and just how I was formed as a human being, and also the pressure I put on myself as a person. And I really wanted to be good at the things that I did, and I brought that attitude and energy to meditation, which probably helped me in certain ways. Certainly, it was one factor that resulted in a lot of discipline, a lot of risk taking. I took a lot of risks by way of leaving certain conventional situations like jobs and relationships and going on long retreats and really practicing a lot. And that wanting to be a good meditator was also a liability, in a sense. I was in my early stages of practice, pushing very, very hard. I was trying to do something rather than to observe what was arising. It took a long time to see that, took a long time to understand that, took a long time to change that. We don't practice meditation actually to become a better meditator. We learn meditation to become better at living our lives. That's why we meditate, right? And the irony of this is one of the greatest and most reliable ways of being better at living our lives is to become a better meditator. So I said at the beginning, by way of an introduction, that tonight's topic has come from some recent reflections or a personal need, or, you know, just the way I've been thinking about my life. And often, very often, this started a couple of years ago, but I would say in the past 6 months, I've noticed this as the predominant motivation. And what's been happening is I wake up in the morning and I ask myself a very simple question. How do I want to experience my own mind and body? How do I want to experience my own mind and body? For me, this has become a near constant guiding question in my life and in my meditation practice. The words, even to me, when I say it out loud or when I write it or when I hear it, it sounds very mundane. How could this possibly be a driving force of maturation in my life or practice? How, and yet, to me, it seems like the most profound question I have come across as a practitioner. Just this. How do I want to... 25 years of meditation practice. This is where I'm left. This question. How do I want to experience my mind and body? Right now. In the next 30 minutes. How do I want to experience my mind and body today? This little question has proven to be have a remarkable impact on the choices I make throughout my day, touching everything from who I spend time with, how often I meditate, what meditation practices I choose to do, what else I prioritize in my life, what I am renouncing or indulging, how often I engage with email and technology, and so much more. This could be a very, very long list. The question touches everything in my life. That's Dhamma. When we have a vehicle or a tool to touch everything in our life, we're getting somewhere. That's Dhamma practice. This one question and how I'm responding to it helps shape my activities and approach to them, and though it does not sound like a very lofty dilemma, this question I find always points me closer to the true Dhamma and a more wakeful way of being in the world. in this moment, I'm quite interested in seeing you, literally with my eyes, of being attentive enough that I have some exposure to and connection with you, even if I don't know you. And that includes the people that are at home and on the screen. I'm very interested in feeling my hips on the cushion beneath me. I'm interested in noticing if and when there's some sort of self-criticism in the mind. Did I say something that didn't make sense? Did I say something dumb? Right. I'm very interested in recollecting that those types of thoughts are habitual and conditioned and don't represent very much about my true nature or true self. And to not get hooked or hung up on them so that I can still see you, literally. I can be in this room, not in my head, right? I want to feel at ease, regardless of the responsibilities I have right now. I want to enjoy being here. I want you to be as comfortable as possible in this space, at this meditation center. I want to feel as safe as possible myself. I just want to be at 8:16 p.m. on Wednesday night, aware of what's happening at 8:16 p.m. on Wednesday night. That's all I want, right? I just want to be right here. It is the most important, 8:16 just became the most important moment of the day. You realize that? Now, pretty soon, 8:17 is going to be the most important moment of the day. But we don't have to live in 8:17 until it's 8:17, right? And 8:14 is already gone. Some of you might know Roshi Norman Fisher, Zen teacher Norman Fisher, wrote, "The most important characteristic, the defining characteristic, I would say, of a spiritual practice is that it is useless." That is, it is an activity that has no other practical purpose than to connect you to your heart, into your highest and most mysterious purpose, a purpose that is literally unknown because it references the unanswerable questions. We do so many things for so many good reasons, for our physical or psychological or emotional health, for our family life, for our economic life, for our world. But a spiritual practice is useless. It does not address any of those concerns. It is a practice that we do to touch our lives beyond all concerns, reaching beyond our lives to their source. Spiritual practice is not actually useless, of course. I've spent a lot of time already tonight trying to convince you otherwise. One thing that is being pointed to is the simple fact that life as it is remains no matter what our practice looks like. Consider the title of Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. spiritual practice does not separate us from life, but rather immerses us fully in it. Norman Fisher, I think, makes a confounding point to force us to reflect deeply. What is spiritual practice for? He says it is useless, then explains the way it opens the heart and touches our whole life. Zen teachers. Spiritual practice is useless if and when it separates us from our whole life, when we use it to hide from our life, or when we think we are more wise and kind than others and develop some spiritual arrogance that separates us from others. I also feel that Fisher is saying that spiritual practice is useless if and when we make of it another project to get more, have more in our life. We don't use spiritual practice for conventional gains, but rather something far more precious. Can you feel your hips on the chair, on the cushion? Can you hear the rain? Can you notice interest, curiosity, suspicion, inspiration in the mind? Because we can wake up at any moment. When we are confronted with pain, our own or another person's, is there some defensive mechanism or habit inside us that keeps us from feeling? Or does the pain touch us? Make us human? A human that feels and is free to experience sorrow. I'll close with a story, and it might be one that you've heard or heard a version of. There are many variations of this story, which is to some degree a near archetypal narrative or even something close to a cliche, though I appreciate the story and I think it has relevance to our theme. An old man in Calcutta would walk to get water from a well every day. He'd carry a clay pot and lower it by hand slowly all the way down, careful not to let it hit the sides of the well and break. Once it was full, he'd raise the pot slowly and carefully again. It was a focused, time-consuming act. One day, a traveler noticed the old man engaged in this difficult task. More experienced with mechanics, he showed the old man how to use a pulley system. This, he said, will allow the pot to go straight down quickly. Then, fill with water and come back up without hitting the sides. It's much easier and the pot will be just as full with much less work. The old man looked at him and said, "I think I'm going to keep doing it the way I always have. I really have to think about each movement, and there is a great deal of care that goes into doing it right. I'd imagine that if I were to use the pulley, it would become easy, and I might even start thinking about something else while I'm doing it. If I put so little care and time into it, what might the water taste like? It couldn't possibly taste as good." The Dhamma makes a very simple case, I think. A charge or a challenge to us. And that is for us to explore and see for ourselves, being present to our lives, the minutia of it all, is a reliable way to handle and to enhance our experience of it. In closing, poet Mary Oliver writes, 10 times a day, something happens to me like this. Some strengthening throb of amazement, some good, sweet, emphatic ping and swell. This is the first, the wildest, and the wisest thing I know, built entirely out of attentiveness. Thank you for your patience and your attention. I want to thank you again for coming out in the rain and for visiting with each other and visiting me. There are many faces here who people who I've not met and don't know yet, and very grateful to spend some time with you. Hopefully, we can practice together. Together again in the future. Thank you, Nico, and everyone at the center for having me here. And I wish you all well, and hope that there was some benefit for you in being here, and hope we see each other again. So thank you very much. Have a good night. Take good care of each other. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.